your science magazine of the air.
Firing time, 25 minutes. Firing time, 25 minutes.
I stood with the rest of the observers on the rim of the sand dune, looking across the desert at the distant scaffolding. I was conscious of two things only. First was the wind, the high, dusty wind that pushed against my face and rubbed a dry, bony hand across my lips. Second was the rocket. Stood on its tail only 1,000 feet away, a finger of black and orange pointed into the cloudless sky. I was nervous. So were the others.
Attention! Attention! All personnel and visitors, attention! 2 minutes before firing, a two-star red signal flare will be shot from the control house. From that moment, everyone will remain exactly where they are. No moving around. When the rocket is launched, watch it carefully. If the rocket spins in its vertical flight, hit the dirt and hit it hard. Firing time, 24 minutes. Firing time, 24 minutes.
In his striving to fathom the mystery of the heavens, man has constantly probed the sky with telescopes, spectroscopes, and radar. By plane, by balloon, even by kite and mountain climbing, the irresistible impulse to rise above the earth has magnetized the imagination of men of all ages. Today, on the March of Science, we bring you the story of an ancient source of power that is now enabling science to send guided missiles over 100 miles into the sky. This we call Rockets Away.
Hit the dirt. Hit it hard. The phrase kept repeating itself like some chuckling echo deep in my brain. I looked to the others at the sand dune we stood upon and made up my mind that I'd hit it so hard and burrow so deep that it'd make a gopher look like a paralyzed mud turtle. I was sweating now. It wasn't because of the heat. A soldier stood near me with that typical calm half-grin that's so infuriating at times like this. I wiped the back of my hand against my lips and turned to him. Pretty exciting, isn't it?
I'll take Las Cruces on a Saturday night.
I suppose this is old stuff to you.
Yeah, you see one rocket go up, you see them all.
Well, don't you... Well, I mean, aren't you worried when it takes off?
Well, mister, it's not the takeoff that worries you. It's the come down.
The come down?
Yeah, whatever goes up, gotta come down. That's the thing to worry about. A couple of tons of steel traveling over 3,000 miles an hour don't land like a butterfly. Seen some dig craters 40 feet across and 20 feet down. How'd you like that if they're dropping your derby?
Yeah, but it can't do that.
Why can't it? You figure it out. What goes up, gotta come down. Oh, want some gum?
Oh, no. No, thanks. What goes up has to come down. Even after I left the sentry, the phrase kept dancing in my mind like a singing commercial. What goes up must come down. Hit the dirt and hit it hard. Oh, brother. Now, the boys back in New York called me a lucky stiff when I drew this assignment. I thought I was, so I packed my kit, met Zimmy, my engineer at Penn Station, and was off to Washington. An army plane was waiting for us. And just at dawn, we took off for White Sands. A parachute bagged under my knees and hooked around my chest made sitting uncomfortable. Squirmed around trying to find a soft spot. I felt as awkward as a rubber plant wrapped in newsprint. And I was conscious of a peculiar feeling of uneasiness. Hard put to put my finger on it at first, but after a bit, the fog cleared and I knew why. I wasn't sure of myself. I was going out to describe to a million or so people the simple fact that a rocket was being shot 60 or 70 miles into the air. I could do that all right. But what I couldn't explain, what really bit into me, was the reason behind it. Why were they trying to shoot a hunk of steel into the blue and empty upper air? What was behind it all? What was the shouting all about? Was it the simple fact that it would go high and fast and far, and that it could, if someone willed it, carry a bomb to blast some city off the map? Well, there must be more I knew, but what? Well, maybe I'd find out. Looked around at my fellow passengers. Most of the others were in uniform. But the chap who sat next to me was as unmilitary as a textbook. He had that tweedy, dangling look that comes from wandering too long in library stacks. Finally, he turned to me and said,
I'm Winslow, professor of physics.
Birch, Bill Birch.
Radio man.
Mm-hmm.
I know your voice.
Say, exactly what pushes these rockets, these V-2s, into the skies?
A law.
A what?
A law. A very simple law. Isaac Newton first discovered it. To every action, there's always an equal and opposite reaction.
What the dickens is that?
Mr. Birch, don't tell me you've forgotten your high school physics.
Yep, I have.
Well, Newton's third law of motion is what sends skyrockets into the air, and V-2s, and roll-bombs, and jet planes.
Hey, let's have that again, and slowly.
To every action, there's always an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah, well, now explain, but easy-like and in short words.
Do you own your own house, Mr. Birch?
Yeah.
Got a lawn?
Sure.
Use a sprinkler, one that rotates?
Yeah.
What makes it rotate?
I never thought of it.
Newton's third law of motion.
Oh.
The jet of water spurting out of the nozzle is an action. This creates an equal and opposite reaction. A thrust in the opposite direction. Follow?
Yeah, that's simple.
Well, that's the basic idea of all forms of rocket power. All rocket engines are called reaction engines. In an ordinary skyrocket, and in the V-2, certain combustibles are either stored or injected into a chamber. When ignition takes place, these combustibles are transformed into gases that are ejected through a nozzle. The stream of gas plunging out of the nozzle causes a reaction that propels the rocket with equal force in the opposite direction.
And the faster the stream of gas...
the faster the rocket moves. Understand that?
Yeah.
Good. Well, now, if you don't mind, I think I'll take a nap. Planes always make me sleepy. Wake me up at Darrow's, will you?
Winslow was a top-notch physicist, I could tell that. But he snored. I wanted to ask him a lot of questions. I wanted to know how he felt about working on war rockets, what his reaction was to the supervision of scientific research by the military. I wanted to know why he spent a lifetime trying to send rockets farther and farther into space. But I didn't. Couldn't seem to form the questions at first, and when I finally did, he was sound asleep. After a bit, after trying half-heartedly to synchronize Winslow's snores with the throbs of the engine, I noticed a book lying next to him. I picked it up and casually riffled the pages. It was a history of rockets. And almost in a half-dream, I began to scan the pages. 2 hours later, 700 miles out of Washington, I was still reading. My eyes began to droop, and then, half aware, I dropped off to sleep.
Equal and opposite reaction
on this glorious 4th of July.
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting.
The Chinese were first. Smart people.
Emissaries from Agni Khan to the imperial ruler of the universe, lord of the land and prince of the sea, Wei Wan.
I come from Agni Khan, whose hordes sit before the walls of Kaifeng. Our army is as numerous as the sands of the Gobi. Our arrows steel-tipped, and our lances are as thick as stalks in a wheat field.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Surrender your city, Imperial Highness.
Sali. Sali! Where are you?
Dear sire.
Oh, you're never around when I need you. You're supposed to be my prime minister.
Oh, dear, he does look ferocious, doesn't he?
Fling him from the palace, Imperial Highness. Our walls are impregnable. Kaifeng shall never fall.
That's what you say. That's what you say. But I'm the one he's after. Pack my bags. I leave.
No, 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 sire. You must stay here.
He who learns to run away lives to fight another day. I take one camel load of royalty, two silken robes, and my number one wife.
Your duty is here, sire. Send the emissaries back to Agni Khan. Defy them.
Who? Me?
Then I will. Return, O ambassadors, to Agni Khan. Tell him that his Imperial Highness defies the hyena of the Gobi.
We will level your city until even the rats will desert it. We take your answer now. to the Khan.
There. You've made him angry. That's no way to make friends and influence people. Now what shall we do? Oh, woe is me. All is lost.
Not yet, sire.
No?
No.
Oh.
Sire, we have a secret weapon.
Secret weapon? What is it?
Tien.
No.
Your imperial inventor, Tingling, has fashioned a weapon that will destroy the hordes of the Khan.
Tingling, that old fraud. He's always inventing something, and it never works. What about the hollow chopsticks, hmm?
That was a good idea, sire. The sticks for eating and the hollowness for use as a straw to sip the tea.
All his ideas are good, but never practical. Well, what is this new secret weapon?
Arrows of flying fire.
Arrows of flying fire? Wonderful.
Do they work? Guaranteed, Your Imperial Majesty.
Tell me more.
It is simple, O light of eternity. All that is necessary is to attach a shaft to some gunpowder containing some arrows.
No.
No, that is not right, sir. Oh, you attach an arrow to some... just a minute, sir. It's so simple. Oh, yes. You attach a tube containing gunpowder to the shaft of an arrow. That's it. When the powder is ignited, the arrow suddenly flies in a straight line against the foe. Here, see for yourself.
And who shall shoot this infernal machine from, what type of bow?
Oh, no bow is necessary, sire. We have merely placed the arrow on a slanted board aimed at the enemy, like so. Now, we ignite the end. Watch, sire. Sit back a bit. It spits fire like a dragon. Ready now, sire. There, sire, is our secret weapon.
Very good, very good. No more demonstrations, please. It's very good. Use it by all means, but not until I'm safe away in the cellar. Why, those things are dangerous.
First noted use of rockets in warfare, A.D. 1232. A narrative of the military operations of the British forces in India against the combined forces of the French, Dutch, and Native armies from the year 1780 to the peace in 1784 by Innes Monroe, Esquire.
Can you make him out, Jones?
Outrider. Looks like Corporal Simmons, the scout.
Tell the men to go easy on the water ration. And make sure they check their ammunition.
Very good, Simmons.
There's Simmons, yes.
Enemy camped in the valley just below the hills in front, sir.
How strong?
5,000 at least.
How far away?
Mile and a half at least, sir.
Is it time for a bit of rest, then?
Yes,
as you were. Get some rest if you can.
Very good, sir.
5,000? That must be the Prince of Mysore and his whole army.
Oh, good enough. Get it over with once and for all. Let it go for these annoying skirmishes, you know. A battle shall be a battle, I say. Give the man a chance to plan his strategy on a broad basis. What's going on? Keep your legs, Batman.
They're using artillery.
How impossible. There are no guns that can carry this bomb.
Captain. Rockets.
What?
They're using rockets. You can see them coming. Look at the smoke trail.
I said, but they can't use rockets. It's a piece of outrage.
Our lanes are gone. The horses are...
But they can't do this, I say. Rockets? Ridiculous. What will the War Office have to say about this? Oh, well, maybe it doesn't matter.
Hey there. Wake up.
Say, you better strap on your safety belt if that's the way you sleep.
Oh, yeah. I must have been dreaming.
Hello. I'm Major Taylor. That rhymes almost.
I'm Bill Birch.
You always bounce in your sleep?
Oh, bad dream. I thought I was with the British Army in India when the natives began to bombard them with rockets. I read about it in this book.
Oh, yes. Well, no wonder you bounced.
British took a licking, huh?
Well, temporarily, but they caught on after a while. A chap by the name of Congreve of the Royal Laboratory began his own rocket research in England and developed a series of powerful war rockets. Very effective, too.
Those were the rockets used by the British against Fort McHenry back in 1814. You know, and the rockets, Rensselaer.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, why weren't rockets used much after that? Not until the past war, anyway.
Well, I'll tell you, Congreve's war rockets were powerful enough, but you see, they were pretty erratic and dangerous. And then when artillery makers began to rifle their barrels and produce an accurate explosive projectile, rockets became obsolete, except for small uses, signal flares, and life-saving mortars.
Oh, it had its ups and downs.
Yes.
A pun? That's again?
Just there.
I'm sorry. Say, is there any single man who can be considered the daddy of the modern rocket?
Well, yes, I guess there is, at that.
Goddard. Dr. Robert H. Goddard.
Never heard of him?
I can't say I have.
Oh, he's a very interesting person. He's a real scientist. Kind of like to hear about. He hated publicity, retiring, but brilliant.
What exactly did he do?
Well, Goddard began making static experiments with rockets while he was at Worcester Tech in 1908. His first paper on the subject was printed by the Smithsonian in 1919. You see, Goddard calculated that only a relatively little fuel would be necessary to lift a rocket to enormous heights, even to the moon, provided the proper fuel was used.
Well, what was that?
Well, you see, previously all rockets were fueled with powder, ordinary gunpowder mixed with saltpeter to slow down the rate of combustion.
No.
Well, Goddard decided the answer to more powerful fuels was liquid rather than powder. So he used a mixture of liquid oxygen and gasoline, and he built a number of small rockets powered by this fuel. He shot one of these rockets off the night of July 17th, 1929. It really caused a commotion. The rocket reached the speed of 100 miles an hour, but the people who saw it thought that an airplane had caught fire. And when Dr. Goddard admitted that it was his rocket and predicted that a trip to the moon was possible, the newspapers really went to town. To say they ridiculed Goddard is putting it mildly.
Dr. Goddard, you wear yourself out prowling up and down the room. It's nothing so terrible.
Of course it's terrible, Henry. Perfectly horrible. All the newspapers flooded with the most fantastic stories about me and my rocket.
I've had 6 telephone calls this morning from people who want to be passengers on the first rocket leaving for the moon.
Real estate operators, no doubt. That's nothing to joke about. You know how carefully I've tried to keep my work from the popular press, at least until the time when I can present it in finished fashion to some scientific journal.
Yes, I know. I've been...
Now, who is that?
I'll go and see.
Yes? Professor Goddard is home. I'd like to see him, please.
If that's a reporter, Henry, let him come in. I want to talk to him.
Come in, won't you?
Thank you,
Dr. Goddard's in the living room. Dr. Goddard...
I want to talk to you. Sit down. Huh? What in the world is wrong with you, newspaper men?
Huh?
Can't you get enough true stories without inventing all sorts of nonsense? The last chain. Now, see here. I did not say I expected to ride a rocket to the moon. I did not say that space travel is only a matter of months away, and I did not say that we'll be able to rocket across the Atlantic in 45 minutes.
Well,
isn't
now...
Isn't it possible for newspaper men to realize this is not a crack-brain experiment by some wild-eyed inventor? I'm a scientist. At least I try to be. I'm not interested in publicity. When the time comes to reveal the results of my experiments, I intend to do it by publication in some recognized scientific journals. Put that in the papers.
I would if I could.
Why can't you?
Because I'm not a reporter.
Huh?
I'm not a reporter.
Then who are you?
My name is George Spanding. I represent the Guggenheim Foundation.
The Guggen...
Oh, I say, that this... I'm terribly sorry.
I'll think nothing of it. I understand how you feel.
It's really very distressing.
I can appreciate that, but I suppose newspapers must have stories, true or not. I was very much interested to read about your rocket, even if the story was colored a bit. Liquid fuel, wasn't it?
That's right. Liquid oxygen and gasoline.
Mm-hmm. Have you been experimenting with liquid fuel rockets very long?
A number of years. But I'm afraid that's all over now.
Why?
In one word, sir, money. I've exhausted all the funds granted to me by the Smithsonian and Clark University, as well as my own. I've reached the bottom of the barrel.
Well, why quit now, if you've made progress?
Well, do you want to quit? I do not. But I can't see that I have any choice.
I think you have. If it's money you want, then it's money you'll get. The Foundation is eager to advance you a substantial sum. How about that? Will you take it?
Will I take it? That's like asking a drowning man if he wants a rope.
I'll take anything you will give me to keep my work going.
Fine. Then consider yourself back in the rocket business.
Yeah?
You see, in World War I, Goddard had worked very closely with the Army. He pioneered the rocket experiments that produced the bazooka and all the other famous American rocket projectiles that were so valuable in World War II.
Well, I always thought Germany had the head start on rocket research.
Only in part. The principles of the German V-2 rocket are based on Goddard's research.
Fasten seatbelt, please. We're coming into land.
Looks like we're here.
Yeah, that's right. I hope you like the show, Mr. Birch.
Oh, I've got a queer feeling. I can't make up my mind whether I'm hungry or scared.
I guess I was mostly hungry because that evening I packed away a terrific meal and felt good all over. About 8 o'clock, our party gathered in the mess hall for a briefing on the V-2. We sat around, newsmen, photographers, radio commentators, columnists, like school kids on the first day after vacation, subdued and anxious. Now, Major Tabor was the briefing officer.
The site of all rocket research in Hitler, Germany, was the little fishing village of Peenemünde on the Bay of Stettin. Now, while this work was top secret, it was not unknown to Allied intelligence. As a matter of fact, two of our agents were in Peenemünde from the very start of the project. Well, skipping over preliminary details, the first V-2 was completed in 1939. The takeoff weight of the rocket was about 14 and a half tons.
The major poured out details in a clear, crisp voice. He told us of the savage bombing raid on Peenemünde, that it literally wiped the village from the face of the earth, and ridding the earth of some 1,500 more or less unmourned individuals, including the commander, the chief of staff, and Ernst Udet, Hitler's ace flying officer. Now, these facts were important. I listened carefully. But all the time, something else was elbowing its way into my brain. It kept bobbing up subconsciously like an invisible jack-in-the-box. When the briefing was over, I stepped outside to light a cigarette. Night was clear and crisp, and the stars had an inviting twinkle. I met Professor Winslow down by the steps. We walked together, silently for a minute or two. And then it popped. What's the idea of it all? What are we trying to find out? I don't know how much money's going into this research, but it must be plenty. Why? To fling a steel pipe against the moon?
Is that all you see in it?
Well, that's the main thing I see.
I'm afraid it's just one small tree in a big forest. You've been a correspondent. Were you in Britain when the buzz bombs started to come?
Why, no.
They weren't accurate, but they were pretty destructive. The V-bombs were worse.
Yeah, but look, that's all history now.
Yes, yes. History already unrolled and history to come. The rocket bomb is here to stay.
Yeah, sure, but...
And the bombs of the future will make those of the past look like harmless children's toys. The British were almost destroyed by those toys. Facing the future, we have to see that we aren't caught off guard as they were. I mean, when really efficient bombs come.
Oh, I see.
That's the Army's job. And of course, the only way to deal with rocket bombs is to know all we can about them. There may be a defense.
There isn't one now?
No. And it's possible that in the future, guided missiles could be sent over the Atlantic or over the Arctic. And could hit New York City. Other nations are experimenting with such missiles. We have to keep ahead of them if we can.
So that's it.
It's a big part of it. But of course, there are other big parts. We may have to tell the world that the rocket bomb is as deadly as the atom bomb. And another argument for world peace. And in the meanwhile, we'll learn things about a big chunk of the universe that we have never looked at before. The upper atmosphere. Remember, instead of explosives, we're sending instruments up in those bomb heads.
They'll tell you about cosmic radiation?
Yes, and about gravitational pull, which hooks up with supersonic speed, and has other possible meanings. What we learn may be of constructive value to man in 1,000 ways, and we can't learn it in a laboratory. Our laboratory's up there. Well, it's good night. I'm going to bed.
The next day was brilliantly clear. We were up with the Army and got more briefing. We were motored over to the site of the launching to see the site and the final preparations, then back to our lookout miles away. As the time approached, I was aware how utterly this waste of land was detached and set miles apart from the rest of the world. There were only the desert, the machines, technicians, and we the observers. Then came the sound of a flare, a signal.
2 minutes to firing time. 2 minutes. Firing time. Please remain where you are.
Okay, Bill, you're on the air.
This is Bill Burt speaking from White Sands Proving Grounds, New Mexico.
by invitation of the War Department, we're about to witness the launching of a captured German V-2 rocket that it is hoped will reach an altitude of 100 miles. The sight of these experiments is as awesome as the giant rocket that now stands just about 1,000 yards away from my point of broadcast. The orange and black of the V-2 stands out abruptly from the whites and purples of the Army Ordnance Proving Grounds. Its sharp nose is pointed straight up into a perfectly cloudless sky, and it seems as though it's flexing its knees, eager to be off. Now, those of us who are here today for this launching realize that we're witnessing one of the triumphs of modern science. Wait, the signal has just come. 10 seconds firing time. Everyone has his eyes glued to the rocket now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. A brilliant orange flame just shot from the bottom of the rocket. It's beginning its trip into space, 100 miles into space.
I've been listening to Your Science Magazine of the Air, brought to you through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Today's program, Rockets Away, was taken from the series entitled The March of Science. We invite you to listen again next week to Your Science Magazine of the Air. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education. Thank you.